In today's episode of the Photo Nerds podcast, we are soaring high with drone photography, we're getting romantic with wedding photography, and we're going to debunk that ISO isn't real.
And then, do we actually say our names at the beginning of the video or not?
Yeah, do we need to say it or not?
Not anymore.
Yeah.
I think you know who we are, don't you?
Yeah.
So what's first on the list for today?
We're going to talk a little bit about wedding photography, aren't we? Because you are the wedding photography.
No, we're talking about ISO then wedding photography.
Okay, all right.
Because the ISO will be short a bit.
Are you boss this week?
I'm not boss.
Are you boss?
We just mentioned it.
Sorry. Paul G. Johnson.
Paul G. Johnson.
Can we just call you Paul for short?
You can.
Thank you.
Or Get.
What are the middle initial stand for?
Get.
Okay, so let's talk about the ISO. There's a video I watched by Tony Northrup, somebody whom I admire very, very much, by the way. But I was quite incensed by his latest video, and I find a lot of his facts to be incorrect. So I'm going out on a limb here, and I'm going to put this to... we actually run a test this morning anyway, didn't we? Let's be honest.
What did Tony say?
Right. What Tony is saying is the ISO, International Standards Organization, doesn't exist anymore. It's basically these numbers are made up. By different camera brands to give the impression that their ISOs are performing much better than they actually are. A bit like going back to the Volkswagen...
emissions tests.
Yeah, the emissions test when I was a real ball ache for them. But so what he's saying is, if you look at certain cameras and certain brands, then they'll produce different results. Well, in my opinion, and I see this every week through training with different brands, I use a light meter. And when I find out what the light meter setting is, I offer the same light meter setting to everybody. And they all input that information into their cameras and the results are always the same. Now, if the results are out by a tenth of a stop, like he made a claim, well, a tenth of a stop isn't noticeable to the human eye. It isn't a tenth of a stop. You know, one stop is noticeable, but even that is very negligible. And I'm not saying for 1 minute that, you know, they're going to be 100% exactly the same, but nor was film to a certain degree. But as a standard, it definitely is a standard. But the other thing that incensed me as well is that he claimed that most people would never notice it because, let's be honest, most of us shoot in a semi-automatic mode or in an automatic mode. And I think that's a bit of a kick in the teeth for anybody who shoots in manual, whether you're a professional or not. And all my work is done in manual.
Mine too.
Especially my professional work, not even my landscape work, which is manual. But, you know, to suggest that we would shoot, or we are shooting, in a semi-automatic mode or a fully automatic mode, I think, is an outrage.
It's certainly not accurate for the majority of the people that I think are watching Tony.
So is he saying that the camera companies are lying to us, pretending their ISO is better?
I think
better controls noise.
He said two things. Number one was that was the intimation of the video, but the other thing was is that we shouldn't really be calling it ISO, similar to your microphone settings. We should be calling it gain. And then he did a test where he shot one image at one ISO setting and another image at another ISO setting, but at the same aperture and the same shutter speed. And he said all you need to do, and you'll get exactly the same results, is to up the exposure in your post processing by, I think it was, four stops.
Well, so he's saying all the camera is doing when you up ISO is doing some different post-processing.
That's it. And I mean...
That doesn't sound right.
It doesn't sound right. And when we did the test, it didn't come out right. I mean, the way...
per his claims.
Yeah, I mean...
Far from it.
If you talk through the technicals, because he was shooting at, what was it,
25,600 ISO.
Yeah.
Was the correct lighting setup.
Yes.
He then reset, he then reshot the same subject
in the same
lighting conditions with the same aperture and the same shutter speed, but then he reduced his ISO down to ISO 400, which is six stops, by the way, and
that he mentioned.
That he claimed.
And then...
Underexposed.
Yeah.
Underexposed.
And then what he did is he took it into post-processing.
That's correct.
And increased it by... four stops.
Well, so the first shot at the moment obviously is going to be lit correctly.
Yes.
But then reduce any ISO right down. But like I say, leaving the shutter speed and the aperture exactly the same, you're then obviously at six stops less going to get a picture that's six stops of light darker.
Yeah.
He said, not to worry though, because if you then increase the light in post-production, it's exactly the same as what your camera would do in camera.
That's right. Well, but when we did the test, we saw two issues with that. Number one, they didn't look the same, even though they were
a mile out.
But number two, why was he doing the test at
5,600 ISO?
Because we then redid the test at a lower ISO, and the amount of noise you got when you increased it by four stops was huge. So it blew that argument out of the water.
That's what you'd expect as well, because ISO on digital cameras, it acts, and for all intents and purposes, when you increase the ISO, for all intents and purposes, you're increasing the sensitivity, although that you're not technically. Mm-hmm. You are increasing essentially the gain of the sensor, aren't you? Increasing the power in it. But
that's correct. But the link, whether that's software or physical, is irrelevant.
Well, yeah, and it is. It's happening in camera, isn't it?
That's correct.
It's got to be software, though, hasn't it? I can't think of any physical way that the camera...
Well, I don't know. It might
maybe
use,
changing the impedance through the sensor or something like that.
It might do. We don't know, do we? I mean, only the camera companies know that. But does it draw more power from the battery for a higher ISO shot?
It must do, because if you shoot at night, for instance, with a higher ISO, then your sensor will warm up. Your sensor will heat up.
That's
sometimes
true.
It can overheat, and then you get burn marks.
Yes.
So it is physically doing something to your sensor within your camera.
Yeah.
But it's all well and good saying an image from ISO 400 to ISO 25,600. But like you mentioned, Paul, when we then reshot it with the same four stops of light, but then we shot it from ISO 100, where it's a crystal clear image, then ISO 1600, where it's not quite a crystal clear image, but then we reduced the darker image in Photoshop.
Yeah, we increased the gain, didn't we?
It was
increased
awful.
It by four stops.
It was absolutely awful compared to setting the camera at ISO 1600, which was the correct exposure in the first place.
So that, for me, it just blows that test out of the water. And I think F-stoppers have done a video where they've basically said roughly the same.
It's interesting, though, because there's a few points, isn't there? Because if ISO... is supposed to be a standard, and it's not an exact standard.
Yeah,
I don't really care, because it doesn't affect my overall photography.
It doesn't affect your triangle, does it?
No.
It doesn't, because you're working with that ISO setting.
It's sort of different. No one's going to shoot four stops underexposed and drag it up in post.
No.
I wouldn't have thought. But if it is the case that some or all of the camera companies are trying to have us over to sell more cameras, then there is an issue there, isn't there? But I haven't seen any evidence of that.
That's a huge issue. I wouldn't want to be having that discussion.
No, and from,
so we're not saying that's the case at all. But when you're looking at ISO, for me, with particularly what we're doing, it's the lower ISO values that are more important. I don't care whether a camera shoots at 4 million. ISO, if they can make those claims, for me it doesn't really matter, because I know what you're going to get from the image anyway, and it's not going to be all that. My concern is how clear those images are at the lower ISOs or the lowest ISOs. Yeah.
But he also said, which I thought was really strange, I mean, the premise of the video was, is ISO fake?
Fake, yeah.
It's irrelevant. At the end of the day, you cannot ignore the third element in the triangle.
Yeah.
You cannot ignore it, because if you ignore the third element in the triangle, which is what he was suggesting, then you'll never be able to guess what the other two settings are or should be.
No.
It's impossible. You can't just leave your camera at ISO 100 forever.
No.
Otherwise, how will you know if the darker image you've just taken is recoverable in post-production?
Of course.
And especially if you're doing it for a client.
Yeah. But especially if you overexpose an image using ISO. You can't drag it back down again, can you?
No.
You can't recover those highlights.
No.
Of course not.
It's all just very confusing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why he's created that video, because it's nonsensical.
The whole discussion is confusing, but it's not backed up with a real-world test that we did, which wasn't a scientific test.
No.
But we thought, hang on a minute, that can't be right. He produced those results because he shot his first image at such a high ISO that it was going to be really, really noisy anyway.
Yeah.
So when he upped his number of stops in post, it was a noisy image as well. But when you took that test and did it at the lower ISO, ISO 400 to 1600, it just poo-pooed his
If the point of his video is to raise an issue he thinks he's discovered around the camera, what the camera companies are deceiving us, and I think that's good. But
good luck with that one, though.
I need to see some evidence and some.
The thing
proof.
Is, I don't
from,
think
from it, what it, Gary's it, saying, that's not the case. If he's got lots of different cameras in his studio all the time,
but I can't be the only photographer out there, surely not, that uses a light meter, because a light meter is way more accurate than any light meter within your camera. And if I was to upgrade or bought a different camera, make, model, brand, whatever, and I bought another camera and I took a light meter reading on a subject's face or whatever I'm photographing, but then the output was different from my camera, the camera would go back. The camera would go back.
Yeah.
or I have a faulty light meter, but... Yeah. I don't have a fault in it because I use it all the time.
I agree entirely, but I think it goes back to your point. It really don't matter. What he showed is he showed a graph and he showed where the D850 was. So its actual ISO was classed as ISO 50 and it came up on his graph at ISO 60. I'm really not that fussed. Mm. It's not going to make that much of a difference when I'm taking the shot because I've got the shot in camera.
Yeah.
So, but it's a really, he's a brave lad to say that we're being deceived by camera companies.
I mean, if it's true, it's a big deal, isn't it? But I haven't seen any evidence of
it. I was incensed more by the fact he said that most of us shoot in automatic, because he certainly doesn't. He's a professional.
Well, he's a professional, but I'm arguing how professional you are to put that test out with the amount of viewers that you've got, with the possible reaction, when that test is, I'm not going to use the word fake, but it just doesn't stack up in the real
world. It
certainly
seems to have raised more questions, doesn't it?
Absolutely, but maybe that was his intention.
Maybe.
Because as I say, I like his channel as well.
But the answer to his question then is ISO fake? It's absolutely not.
Yeah, no.
Whether it's physical or whether it's software, the fact is it's a third element and you can call it what you want, because you mentioned about calling it a different name, calling it gain or something.
Yeah.
Well, you can call it what you want, but at the end of the day, it still has to be part of your calculation.
Of course it does.
It does.
Yes.
Absolutely. And I just don't understand it.
It's a consequence of getting too focused on the technical stuff, isn't it?
I've
talked a few times where I've said, ISO, you're increasing the sensitivity.
Yeah.
And I know technically that's not the case.
Yeah.
But for all intents and purposes, you are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like the sensitivity of a film.
I think you must be doing.
But whatever the technical issues are, the output is that it's more sensitive, isn't it? Like it's
more sensitive to light.
Yeah, technically that's not the case, but it doesn't matter, does it?
In
terms of what, like getting the triangle right.
Yeah,
it just doesn't matter. So yeah, it's.
But you see, technically,
fair play to him though.
Technically, I think it must do. It must make the sensor more sensitive. It must do. Because it reacts to light quicker.
Yeah. Well, we're unqualified to talk about.
We are. We're unqualified.
Well, is it whether it's software or hardware? The fact is, it still has to be part of your calculation. And the minute you move away from that, then
But I'd be really interested
to know. Very dangerous.
To get the views from people who are watching.
Yeah.
And what they think.
Well, we'll put the images up that you've taken. We'll put the
fine.
That'd be great, because then you guys can make your own mind up.
Yeah.
You know, don't take our word for it. You just have a look and see what you think.
So if you are listening to this on a podcast now, apologies, but we'll put the pictures up over the fact that we're talking and not just a 30-second gap in audio.
I think they'll just be playing, won't they? But I think that it would be good is if you are listening on podcasts and it does interest you, just go and hit the YouTube channel and have a quick look.
Yeah, or you can go to photonerds.co.uk and I'll put them on there as well.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. Or you can email Paul G. Johnson.
Yeah, with his scarf.
Yeah, but okay, so let's move on from that, because obviously it gets really boring and I don't want to concentrate, like you said, too much on the technical aspect.
But I think that was a great discussion anyway. Yeah, something that got...
But Tony Northrup, by the way, I'm a great admirer of him and his channel.
Yeah.
What's wrong?
You love him.
No, you're looking at me as if I've got something on my face.
No, you love him.
Should we talk about weddings then? I want to talk about weddings.
Absolutely. That's something different. Something a little bit different, but it's something
joyous.
I, other than getting married, I've got no experience of, and other than the photographer who took pictures of my wedding, overexposed them all. But
you've been to weddings though.
I've been to a few, but I can't remember.
You've heard of
weddings. Because I'm normally the one slumped in the corner at 3:30. And I'm not lying.
But do you turn into a nasty person when you?
I don't. I just fall asleep.
Happy drunk.
You guys have got experience of weddings, so I'm going to sit here and just listen.
Yeah, me by no means the experience Gary has, I don't think. But do you like doing weddings?
I love them. I do. I really look forward to doing weddings, and I question my own sanity when it comes to that. But I do. I think it's a very underrated genre of photography. It isn't underrated if you go to the award shows and see how amazing some wedding pictures are. Having said that, though, it's a bit like Instagram landscape pictures. Do you know what I mean? If you look at a landscape picture that's on Instagram that's doing the rounds, that's absolutely out of this world, chances are it is. Do you know what I mean? And yeah, it's very similar to that nowadays with weddings. In other words, it's not Mr. and Mrs. Smith that got married at the Cedar Court Hotel on Saturday. You're never going to produce a world-winning, an award-winning image from that scenario. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Everything is perfect. Perfect bride, perfect groom, perfect scenario. Chances are lots of it has been manipulated to high heaven. Not that I have a problem with any of that, really, if I'm honest, but most of it is also staged for award work.
Yeah.
Do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there are some rules where I've had my pictures thrown out of competitions because they deemed that it wasn't a real wedding when it was.
That's what you mean.
Yeah, and I'll give you just a great example of that very quickly is if we shoot a bride and groom in a church, one of the things I love to do, when we bring a bride and groom out, all the guests come out, but we sneak the bride and groom back into the church afterwards because it does two things. One, I won't bore you, but it gives the opportunity for all the guests to disappear and go on to the wedding venue instead of all hanging around because that eats into our wedding time. But then when we take them inside the church, if it's a really nice church, is we can get some lovely pose stuff in the church, you know, from, as you can imagine, lighting coming through the church windows and so on and so forth. It's lovely. And we like to do that. And when I put a couple of pictures in for competition, I had them thrown out because I said it couldn't have been a real wedding because there was no guests in the church. So they just naturally assumed because right, nobody else does it.
Yeah.
Well, you've obviously got, you know, a model bride and a model groom and you've just took up to some random church because it looked nice, posed them and took some pictures. How bizarre is that?
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting... I mean, that for me about wedding photography is one of the interesting things about what your process is as the photographer and what role you play in the day. So, like, because when I do weddings, I'm more... kind of, I like to stay out of the way because I'm quite a big lad anyway. Like, I'll sort of stay out of the way as much as possible. That's generally what my clients come to me for as well, is to have sort of someone.
We pretty much run the day.
Do you? Mm.
Yeah, between the wife and I, we pretty much run the day. But we warn them against don't take this the wrong way, but we warn them against employing people like you because you don't know what a candid... I don't have a problem with candid photographers, by the way, but if you order a candid photographer or book a candid photographer, you essentially don't know what you're going to get. You don't, but
what,
with
even
us...
Even if you can see the work that they've produced in the past?
Yeah, absolutely, because... because you're only going to be able to capture what happens candidly. Wherefore, right or wrong, but if I pose people, you know that if you enjoy getting posed, you know the sort of pictures that you're going to get.
Yeah.
100% guaranteed.
So how much time are you taking out of the bride and groom's day then?
And that's all factored in. It's we say 2 hours. But 2 hours from the time when you finish getting married to 2 hours when you sit down for the wedding breakfast.
Really?
Yeah, 2 hours, yeah. Yeah.
What, that they're not with their guests?
No. That'll be to cover the boring personal pictures that you have to, the mums and dads and the family shots that you have to do. But then we will take them away, and very often we'll take them away from the venue. But of course, we have this discussion with them. We don't just land it on their laps. Mm. But if they're getting married at Cedar Court Hotel and they might come in here and look at the pictures on our wall and think they're really nice and we want that, but we're getting married at the Cedar Court Hotel, well, you can't have that. If you're getting married at the Cedar Court Hotel, you know, these lovely palatial shots with castles in the background or water in the background. However, you know, we can accommodate it if you allow us time to jump in our car, disappear with us for 45 minutes, usually to an hour.
Mm.
But as long as you factor that time in and tell your wedding guests what you're doing, it's no big deal.
Yeah.
But that's just how we work, that's all. But with a candid photographer, I've had quite literally people who have been on my wedding courses and they've rung up. I can show you emails and they've rung up and said, we just got our wedding pictures back. We didn't book you because we couldn't afford you or whatever. So we got a candid photographer in. Obviously, he was new at his job. But listen to this. There wasn't one picture of us together all day as a bride and groom. But because I know weddings that well, you as a bride and groom are never together on your wedding day.
No.
Never. You're not.
Yeah, I mean, that's just smacks of inexperience, doesn't it? It's not like...
Yeah, but bride and grooms aren't together on a wedding day unless they're doing their vows or they're told to stand somewhere.
Mm.
Then the lad's off with his mates because he's got all his mates to come to his wedding. The bride's off with all her friends, all the college and students.
Yeah.
And that, it ends up as a big party more often than not. They don't walk around holding hands like they used to years ago. Talk to this guest, talk to that guest, and you're snapping away. That doesn't happen anymore.
In my experience, what's the difference between a candid photographer and...
Well, I'm one, Gary's the other.
Right.
So the way I do it is mostly documentary-type candid shots.
Okay.
So that you... But there are certain parts of the day where I'll bring people together. So, for example, start the day at the bride's place.
Yeah.
Some certain setup shots there.
Yeah.
Makeup artists, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Get her to pose with her family and that sort of thing. Then get to the venue ahead of the bride, do a bit with the groom and his mates. Then obviously shoot the ceremony. But then afterwards go to the venue and I will generally try and then take them away for 20 minutes, half an hour for me personally.
Yeah.
And then but at the venue most of the clients that want to work with me don't want to go off driving like all over the place. They just want nice shots in it without the photographer sort of interfering with their day.
Sure.
And then I will say to people in the booking process, I'm not a fan of the setup family shots, but I understand that you need some of them for your grandma or your auntie. So I recommend you stick to 6 shots maximum setup. Because it kills your day, and you need to have your ushers getting people into the shot because that's not my job.
No, it certainly bores the hell out of the guests as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So
the bride and groom,
and then apart from those two bits, I'm then just staying out of the way. So the dinner, I don't shoot when people are eating, but the speeches, obviously, I'm shooting. Mm. Sometimes doing video as well, and then the ceremony, the cake cutting, all that sort of stuff. I'm just off it. In staying out of the way as best I can while still getting good shots. Obviously, there are times like the cake cutting where you're going to have a million other people with a camera behind you.
Mm.
Just speak to the clients beforehand saying, when that happens, you look at me.
That's experience, isn't it, as you say.
Yeah.
We boss them about anyway. But the way I work is not too dissimilar from the way you work there. Exactly the same. You know, we'll take them away. It's all well and good me sat here saying, we'll take them away for an hour and a half. That's the worst case scenario. We generally take them away for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, like you just said. Obviously, if they're getting married in the grounds where we can just walk a minute and then we're away from the guests and we can do our posy stuff, do the hand... holding hands, walking stuff, blah, 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 you know, so it's not too dissimilar. But then I also come back and shoot the candid stuff with the guests talking, the guests laughing.
Yeah.
But more often than not, you know, that's your candid stuff. Here, take a picture of me. Take a picture of me. Tattoos everywhere. I don't know why I went into that then all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's a Manchester pose, didn't you? Oasis.
It's the same. When I started out to be a wedding photographer, I bought loads of videos from the world's best photographers, and I wanted to replicate them and be better than them. That was my plan, of course.
Yeah.
That was my plan, but that's just me. When we talk about what you mentioned on that last vlog, about you had a plan.
Yeah.
The only plan I ever have is, right, if I'm going to start something, I don't just want to be a run-of-the-mill, one of these guys that does it.
I want to be the best.
I want to be the best. Whether that turns out or not is irrelevant.
Yeah.
The fact is, you have to have those goals, or what's the point in doing it?
I think that's one of the things I sort of heard when I started doing photography and wanted to be taken seriously as a photographer, is that people said, I'm not sure I even agree with this, but people said, in order to cut your mustard as a proper photographer, professional photographer, you've got to do weddings at some point.
Yes.
Because there's nothing else like it.
No.
Yeah, that's right.
And whilst I agree that there is nothing else like it, there also, I don't think that's necessarily true.
Yeah, I think
but it does provide unique opportunities as a photographer.
I think it will do, but I think it's up to Buncombe, to be honest.
No, I think it is as well.
I don't think to be a proper photographer, you have to do anything. You just go out and shoot. And yeah. You mentioned it on your video 2 weeks ago. I think it was 2 weeks ago, is experience with the camera. That's maybe where that's coming from, but you can do that, taking pictures of fish.
No, I agree. I don't agree with that bit, I don't think. But
just before we change the subject, the one thing when I, because I teach wedding photography, and the one thing that I tell people, and you can see it on their face instantly, forget how good you are as a photographer. You've got to be a people person.
Oh, yeah,
if you're not a people person, you're in the wrong industry.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, grab your camera and go photograph fish in a bucket or something, because wedding photography is just not for you.
No, and it is difficult. I mean, I've observed being enjoying photography. I've observed other photographers at friends' weddings. And I watched a guy, it was my cousin got married a couple of years ago, and he was absolutely brilliant at how he directed the people.
Yeah.
And you've got one person going off for a fag when they've come out of the church, but he managed to herd everybody together and kept them there for the minimal amount of time.
Yeah.
And then he did what you two guys did and took them off to a separate location, which was in the grounds, and took pictures. And then obviously he did his formal stuff for during the speeches and everything. And then he was there most of the evening getting those candid shots. Done it again. Getting those candid shots.
One of the problems that you've got to overcome as a photographer, as a male photographer particularly, is you're going into often a female bride's house with all her mates and her mum.
Yeah.
And if you are a creep, you're going to ruin the day in the first 20 minutes before the bride's even dressed.
You won't be allowed in.
Well, I can understand that.
But I mean, I think the most important thing with wedding photography, if you've not, particularly if you're doing your first few, is to just communicate with the bride and groom a lot beforehand. Like, let them know what you do, understand what their expectations are, and then you come to some agreement in the middle often.
Mm.
And that's how it always is for me. So there's no surprises later down the line that are going to cause you issues and going to cause you extra work as well.
I admire you both, because there's no way in a million years. Even
what modes do you shoot in?
Manual all day.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. Same as me.
Yeah. I wouldn't in a million years ever entertain doing friends' wedding or doing it commercially. Because the stress levels there.
Do you know what I am? I'm a thumbnail anal passage, and I show people this all the time. When I bring thumbnails up, I want to see consistency with lighting before I even open those pictures. If you're shooting anything but manual, I don't care how good your camera is, unless you are in a sterile environment where the light definitely is not going to change 100%. Even the fact that you've got a window or curtains open, that's going to be not such a sterile environment, if you know what I'm saying. And I need to look at my thumbnails, and I need to see consistency.
Yeah, you're creating yourself an impossible editing task.
Absolutely.
If you're shooting in one of the automatic modes, even aperture priority.
Interesting to know that. But what do you change when you're shooting manual? Do you just stick to one aspect that you're changing throughout it? So, I mean, for example, are you playing with that triangle? Are you playing with ISO? Are you playing with
shutter speed all day long?
With all three?
All day long.
I adjust aperture less than anything else, because I'll set the aperture based on the depth of field I want. So for a group shot, I'll increase the aperture because I want that bigger depth of field. Because if people are misaligned a bit, or they're in a bit of a curve, you need that extra depth of field.
So what are you shooting at in a group shot? What would you be shooting at, for example, aperture?
5.6 probably on most occasions, maybe a bit less depending on the distance between you and the background.
And if it's an intimate shot with the
I'd stick at 2.8. Like, I use zoom lenses all day, so I'll have the 24-70 2.8, and then I'll have the 70-200 2.8.
You will find most wedding photographers shoot wide open.
Yeah. And you're the same.
Yeah.
But then it's in the church particularly, where you're going to spend a bit of time. You can just get your manual settings done, and you're done. You can just forget about about your settings throughout the whole ceremony.
Yeah.
The problem with it, if you're in aperture priority mode particularly, is say if you you spin round to take a shot of a family member in the front row who's wearing a black suit, and then you go back to the bride who's in white.
Yeah.
The meter will read that differently.
It's going to screw settings up.
Yeah, and you get, like Gary says, you get inconsistent exposure across, because you want to be able to edit it quickly and paste settings across a few shots with wedding photography editing. I do anyway.
Yeah.
To save myself a bit of time. I'll go over them eventually to tweak them a bit. But I don't want to have to be editing every single image completely individually.
Well, light skin, dark skin, bride's always in white.
Yeah.
Groom's nearly always in dark clothing, whether it's a colourful dark clothing, it's still always blue or brown or something. Mm. You know what I mean? Yeah, absolutely. It's like
I try to make it easy for myself sometimes, though. So, say if you're in it's a cloudy day, I will have the ISO setting a bit. I might go ISO 400, which I need for the cloudy conditions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then when the sun comes out, I'll just roll the shutter speed up. Right, I'll leave it at ISO 400. And just roll the shutter speed up.
What's interesting with the what you've both been saying is that goes back to your point that somebody said, if you want to be a good photographer, shoot weddings. And now I can understand where he's coming from, because it's teaching you a hell of a lot. Yeah. You know, it's got to be instinct that you know what those settings need to be and for that environment.
That's true. And on top of that, you get one chance at each of the moments, don't you?
There's
a few of those moments during the day, like the actual... the first kiss, walking down the aisle, the cake cutting, the speeches and stuff. You get one chance to get it right. So
whatever that chap was that said to you, that was a good idea, and I said it was bunkum, I retract that statement.
But I tell you, wedding photography, which is a photography in general, which a lot of people don't actually know this, but you know the triangle?
Yeah.
Well, the triangle should be a square.
Yeah.
Because there's four elements, not three elements, and the fourth element is your flash. But believe it or not, your flash works in exactly the same way as your ISO, your shutter speed, your aperture. In other words, they work in stops of light.
Mm.
So if you turn your flash to manual and turn it up to full power, then if you turn the power down, it goes from full power to half power, from half power to quarter, to 8th, 16th, 32nd, and so on and so forth. That works in exactly the same way as your shutter speed, your ISO, and your aperture. They're all in stops of light.
Mm. Mm.
But it's very easy. It's very easy to figure it out. Mm. But also, there's lots of repetition. So if I come from outside and walk into a church, I can pretty much set my camera settings at the hip.
That was what I was going to ask
you. So you know instantly, the minute I walk into a church, I can look at the light in a church and know it's 1600 ISO or 3200 ISO. Aperture is always going to be wide open.
Yeah.
And then you're always at that point, you're going to be around about 125th of a second for shutter speed.
Do you find that different places, because you'll obviously salute local places as well, so do you find that you go to such and such a church and you know straight away what your settings are going to be within that church?
The minute you walk in,
seconds.
But again, one last thing just before we change it, and you should see people's faces when we do the wedding photography courses, is I always tell them, right, the biggest shock for them is I won't allow them to look at the pictures on the back of their camera. If they do, they'll get a slap.
Yeah.
In a nice way.
Yeah.
But that means, because I want to educate them in the art of shooting in manual. Mm. So I'll always say, right, okay, set your camera up. I won't bore you with all the detail, but set your camera up. Take a test shot. If you're happy with a test shot, then like Adam says, nothing is going to change.
No.
If the light isn't changing, your camera isn't changing. So therefore, now you can become what I consider to be a photographer.
Yeah.
Communicate with people, give instructions, take pictures, and stop doing this. Taking a picture and looking at the back of the camera because it's awful. And the minute you see somebody do that, you know that they're very inexperienced.
Yeah.
Very inexperienced.
But it goes back to your analogy that you mentioned a couple of podcasts ago about putting your settings on, taping them up, and then going out and shooting.
Yeah.
Because of the experience that you've had with light, you know what those settings are, which will produce certain results. And it's the same with them. Because if you're taking something out of the equation for wedding photography, aren't you?
Yeah.
That it's hard enough making sure that your compositions are right and that you're getting people and communicating with them without having to worry about, well, does it look right? Does the exposure look right?
Yeah.
That should be given. It's like driving a car, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I do look at the screen sometimes, not after every shot as well, but I'm just curious apart from anything. I want to see them. And then I also show the people that I'm shooting a lot of the time. Yeah. Like particularly if they're uncomfortable having their picture taken, I'll just say, look, it's a really good one.
I'm not saying never to do that, because I've done the same thing, especially if I get excited by something. if I get, because I do, I still get excited by certain shots, and I'll show them so they can see, oh my God, yeah, that's amazing. Especially if you're doing something like off-camera flash where you're bringing a light down in the sky and they're seeing pictures they wouldn't ordinarily or could understand how you're taking, and you show them it and all of a sudden, wow, and then they'll perform for you much better.
Is when you mentioned a couple of weeks ago on your vlog about getting out and taking more shots, is that something that maybe you two would encourage people to do from a non-commercial point of view? Is if you're
or weddings.
If you not get paid for it, but, you know, to take shots at the wedding, or does that, will that interfere with the photographer himself doing his work?
I don't care. Like, people, some wedding photographers get really upset about other people with DSLR cameras particularly. I don't care.
With guests?
Yeah, for the guests have got... Not following you, but...
Yeah, I'm just thinking it's from an experience point of view. If somebody's going to a wedding and we've been talking about that triangle or that square in instance with the flash photography, is that they could maybe go and then
Not with a flash. Yeah, I have an issue with a flash because that would get in the way of my shots. But if they've just got... If they've got a DSLR with a 50mm on it, good luck to them. I don't care. As long as I've spoken to the bride and groom already, they've paid me to do the wedding, so they know they need to look at my camera.
Like, is it a good way to gain experience with the camera?
I don't see why not. Like, as long as you're not interfering with.
I really think that I take it as given that people understand that triangle and not having to look at the back of the camera to understand whether or not they're getting their exposure right. Because for me, it is like second nature. When I drive a car, I don't think about changing gears.
Where did you learn that, though? Was that,
that's just experience, isn't it?
From just doing landscape photography or
other photography as well, taking pictures of the kids, taking pictures of dogs, but primarily landscapes.
Yeah, you've done it for a long time as well, haven't you?
Too long.
I see some new landscape photographers. That's why they bought a camera, because they want to do landscape photography, which is great.
Yeah,
but the shutter count they're getting just isn't enough. To be getting that.
You'd be surprised at the number of actuations that are on my 800, because if I go away on holiday, I'm not one of these people that's got the strap around the neck, nothing wrong with that, but I will take the camera out and I will just go for those candid shots and I'll just nip off for half an hour.
What, handheld?
Handheld, yeah. And I'm just playing around with settings and just learning how that camera works. And so it's second nature. So when it needs to be me to get that shot, I'm not even thinking about it.
I mean, one of the things I would say is that when you start in photography, start with that camera in your hand. Yeah. Don't put it on a tripod
on
the first ever time you pick up a camera. Have a play with it. Get a feel for it in your hand.
Yeah, but it's easy to learn about manual because you can do that in your bedroom.
Of course you can.
You can do
and
that
I've done
in
it. And I've done it in my bedroom.
We've all done it.
I have, but I've sat there. It's particularly when you get a camera.
We did it with some apples. Yeah. Well, you did it with some apples earlier.
This morning. Yeah, he's been doing it with apples.
So have you two got that now then? Do you understand how that works?
Yeah. It's better than sheep, isn't it?
Right, let's move on to... Shall we move on to something a little bit more exciting? Because I can imagine that... Talking about wedding photography won't appeal to...
It won't appeal to everybody, but I think what we are doing is aiming with this podcast is not just to talk about landscapes.
Yeah, absolutely.
We want to talk about everything photography. We have mentioned street photography.
But it's also very interesting to see how somebody works in a... I'm not saying a very different way, because you'd be surprised.
Well, we've not talked about it before, really.
We actually thought
we were quite different, didn't we?
But and you're almost the same, which is great.
Should we talk about drones then?
Now we're not talking. Well, we are. We're going to.
Let's talk about something exciting. Yeah, let's drone.
Couple of things, drones. But we're going to talk about drone photography, aren't we? As in taking pictures with a drone.
Because you said the other week that you were giving up on your drone.
Yeah. Well, I've turned professional. I might have changed that. I might not be quite going back to basics.
Are you not selling it?
I'm thinking that maybe no, I won't.
Have you done much photography with your drone?
I haven't, no, I'll be honest with you. Mm. I pulled a couple of stills off 4K, but I haven't taken photographs or images with it. I'm more scared about flying the thing than concentrating on getting a good composition.
Oh, no, flying them's easy.
Yeah.
That's me.
Yeah, you crashed too. But what has concerned me, it has been negativity towards drones per se in the public eye and also the legalities behind flying drones. Now, I come from a pilot background. I've got a commercial pilot's license. So I know who...
Oh, have you?
We keep finding these things out about
you. I know you do. I've been like under a bushel, me. But I understand who owns the airspace. And the airspace is not owned, but is governed by the Civil Aviation Authority in this country. And they are responsible for anything that flies. But, for example, the National Trust have now got bylaws in place, I think, and I may get shot down here, that says you cannot fly drones on our land. Well,
isn't there a blanket ban throughout the whole of Dartmoor, for instance?
Well, there could be, but see, I don't know about Dartmoor because there's a lot of places that are military zones, so there'll be low-flying aircraft,
although
which
totally
may be banned.
That,
not from the CAA point of view. They won't allow even light aircraft in those areas. But from a drone point of view, the governing body as to who is operating those drones, either commercially or privately, the rules and regulations are set by the CAA.
It's a real shame, I think, around drones, because they're amazing bits of kit for video and for stills. I haven't done much stills work with a drone, even though you can get a really interesting perspective a lot of the time, because for me, the sensor quality isn't there yet. Like, particularly on my drone, the Mavic, the original Mavic, it's very noisy.
I've got the same one.
So in terms of producing the sort of landscape photography I want to produce, the sensor just doesn't do it yet. And I don't want to buy a separate drone just to take stills with a better sensor. So I'm kind of just biding my time on that. But the negative press around it outweighs the problem, I think. Mm. It's a problem of a few idiots, particularly ones flying them around airports, that doesn't link to what the likes of us are doing.
I'll say that, but there is there are rules and regulations regards aircraft and flying.
Yeah.
So when I see a picture or a video which is being taken, not necessarily by us landscape guys, but I'll give you an example. Casey Neistat, for example. Every time he flies his drone, he's breaking the law in America from a federal aviation point of view. I've seen some beautiful images. For example, there was one image, I think it was Rome or Turin, where the guy had taken the shot looking straight down at the buildings, and it was a stunning shot. But that's an illegal shot. You can't fly those drones over habitable areas against the law.
Should we cover off, just as we've got an audience here, let's just cover off what the drone code says, which is what...
And now, you've already...
I've done some research, So basically, the drone code says in this country, not the US, in the UK, is don't fly near airports or airfields. That's a no-brainer.
Makes sense,
For most people with a brain. Zone now, I think.
Remember to stay below 400 feet or 120 metres.
Yep.
Observe your drone at all times. Stay 150 feet away from people and property.
Yep.
So the first two are the law. The second, that one isn't. The distance is not. That's just part of the code.
Right.
And that's difficult.
It's a grey area.
Very grey area.
You see, I'm really, really surprised that that last one is not in the law, because that is potentially... the aircraft being...
Well, you mean fly away from people?
Yeah.
You can't.
Stay in 150 foot as much as is practicable.
I've been out, my eyes are not great. So I've been flying a few times with a mate, and he can see it, and I've lost it ages ago.
Yeah.
And there is a grey area, even with people's eyes in that.
It's the near people and structures that worries me.
Yeah, never fly near aircraft. Enjoy responsibility. Don't fly over people near 50 metres within people, I think.
Is that law?
Not sure. I think it's just the height. It's the height in the airport.
But it's a grey area, that, though, isn't it? Because how can you enforce that? Because, like, say, for example, when Adam and I went up the Lake District, we were on top of a mountain. There was one other person there. Does that mean to say that because one person's there, we can't fly?
No, you don't. You just stay away from them. You don't fly above them, and you stay away from them. The thing is I know for a fact that if, for example, you're in a light aircraft and there was somebody on Windermere in a rowing boat, and I went over the top of them in the aircraft, and it wasn't within the minimum altitude, that individual could report me to the CAA, and I could have my license revoked. In fact, it happened to somebody when I lived in America. He flew and buzzed a guy in a rowing boat, and the guy in the rowing boat was the state supervisor for the Federal Aviation Authority, and he lost his license. So, and I'm really surprised that from a drone point of view, that people can get away with flying close to structures and above a town, for example.
They asked the lonely toys, remember? They asked the lonely toys.
A toy falling from 400 feet if it has a power failure and lands on a car.
They can cause damage, can't they?
Or they'll kill you.
The thing with the height as well, one of the interesting things, particularly for us, the likes of us that shoot in the mountains, is that it's height above the ground. So yeah. some people thought it's, there's been a lot of talk when these level. When the law came in last year.
Above sea level, you mean?
No, it's above ground level is what, people, is what they're
what
talking
a lot
about.
Of people said when the law first came out, that it's you can fly 120 metres over the point that you took off from.
Right.
Which is not the case. It's the where the drone is. Mm. So the drone cannot legally, obviously it can.
But so if you're 2,000 feet up a mountain,
yeah,
you can fly 400 feet above that.
Yes, but okay. Then if you fly off the mountain,
right,
you're then much higher than the
it's
drone.
It's 1,000 feet off the floor.
Exactly, yeah.
And right. Vice versa. So if you're going up the mountain, yeah, as long as you're three,
you can go higher,
four,
yeah,
you can't go anywhere.
So it's all grey, isn't it? Really, the
it's
area.
Not,
it,
no,
it's not.
The
pretty black and white.
The trouble is it's not grey. It's not. And it's absolutely fine as long as nobody gets injured. And that's what concerns me.
I think you can stay within the rules in terms of the law and still get great shots. That's my... I don't go over 400 feet.
Yeah.
I don't fly near airports, and I still get all the shots I need.
Did you do any research on the bylaws?
Yeah,
the National Trust.
Yeah.
Because I think that's important. So and the reason that we're mentioning this is not because of people who are vlogging that going out and shooting. Drones are now coming down in value that a keen photographer could decide to buy one to get unique landscape photography
shots.
It's
all the rage on Instagram, isn't it? Yes. These sort of these drone shots with different perspectives.
And that's why we're covering it, not just from a vlogging perspective.
I must admit, I do miss mine. Mm. just in case anybody out there doesn't actually realise, I lost two drones pretty much, I suppose, really through my own stupidity. But I lost two drones in a 12-month period, and my last one I lost was a Mavic. So, you know, it's a great expense to myself, really. Mm. But I must admit, when it comes to filming and vlogging, there's a couple of videos I've seen from other YouTubers, shall we say, that I thought was absolutely fantastic, but their videos wouldn't have been anything without the drone work added to it.
Yeah.
Only because the areas in which they were filming suited, yeah, just awesome, and I really do miss
it. It's nothing new in film, is it? We've always had
aerial shots.
Aerial establishing aerial shots have always been a thing.
Yeah.
But with the National
the bylaws,
with the National Trust, so when you first go on their website about drones, I'll read it out to you. It says the use of UAVs or drones is not permitted on or over National Trust land as part of our bylaws without the necessary required qualifications and a license granted by us. Now that's fine, but it's so negative and against any kind of creativity or enjoyment of what the vast majority of us are doing.
But also, that's not enforceable.
I would really like to understand the CAA law on that.
Yeah.
So the CAA's guidelines.
I read a few. I didn't find it for fact, but there was a lot of discussion about, do the National Trust own the airspace
they
above
their
land?
They absolutely don't.
But so what a lot of people were saying is that if you take off from National Trust land and then fly over it, they've got nothing to do about that.
They can't do anything about it either if that doesn't touch the ground. So if you saw another landscape vlogger the other week who caught his drone, and I wouldn't recommend it because I really hurt myself doing it, but he caught his drone. Well, it's not landed on National Trust property.
So when I was researching this, one of the things that annoyed me a little bit about the blanket opinion of the National Trust, which covers some of those beautiful places in this country, and I'm a member of the National Trust, so I really,
me too,
they're pretty special.
Me too.
But what the sort of blanket decision just to not allow them, I think is wrong. And when you look at their website, particularly, they don't really give you very much information beyond that. National Trust for Scotland say they want you to enjoy it if you've got the right stuff in play. But the National Trust in England is not. And the thing is, they're threatening you with these bylaws right from the very first paragraph. And there's a good reason why they're not giving you any more information. And I don't want to say this so people are going to go and fly their drones in stupid ways, but I'm just giving you the facts, basically. So the fact is, when you search for these bylaws, they are proper law. So it's legislation that was brought in 1965. I think it's the National Trusts Act, the National Trusts Act, I think it is, of 1965 that has the bylaws. The punishment for breaking these bylaws is a £20 fine.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So that's why they're not telling you that, though, because people aren't going to be that bothered. I think you'd risk it for £20, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But I don't want people to just go and start being stupid, because...
No. But the reason that they brought this in and highlighted it on the website is drones are unequivocally very unpopular with the public.
Mm.
There is a very small proportion of people that are drone fans. If somebody sees a drone, because
they're fans of the footage, though, aren't they?
They're fans of the footage, yeah. But human nature is there's one of those awful drones.
Mm.
You know, with
that's because that's what the narrative has been, though, in the press, isn't it? It's about fear, right? Yeah. And making people think that every time a drone flies over their head or near them, they're getting filmed.
It's the same with the gun laws, though. 20 years ago, handguns were banned because some crazy man walked into Dumb Lane and shot all the school children, and handguns were banned. But that doesn't stop the criminal element from still using handguns in crime.
No.
And it's the same with drones. You can ban the drones, and the criminals that are using drones to fly into prisons to drop drugs off or whatever will still carry on using them. It's the law-abiding citizens like me.
A drone isn't a tool that's been designed to kill people, is it?
It isn't designed to kill people, but the people that commit these atrocities with a handgun are not normally everyday Joe.
No.
Well, they're not law-abiding citizens, clearly.
No.
Well,
no, they're not.
The case. Yeah, but it's the same thing for bicycles and mopeds. I mean, look what it's like in London at the moment. That's on the news all the time.
Mm.
You get gangs going around in mopeds and they're attacking people and pinching handbags. People on the phones, they're just driving past. The person on the back is grabbing the phone and off they go because you can get anywhere with a moped.
But they're not
banning mopeds in London, are they?
No. I mean, and knife crime is rife in London at the moment, and they're not. It's very, very difficult to ban. Nice, because they're in everybody's home, isn't it?
That's right.
But
everybody's always got an excuse for having a knife in their back pocket.
Drones are an easy target.
But is banning everything the way forward?
No.
It's not, is it? I don't want to live in a society like that. It's,
no.
And changing the laws now that you now have to register your drone, which is basically going back to what you're saying,
it's
a pointless exercise.
Yeah.
Because all that's going to happen is the law-abiding citizens like myself and you guys here, we're all going to register our drones.
Mm.
But, you know, if you are going to use it in an improper fashion... You're not going to bother registering. You're going to buy one on eBay, and you're not going to... Do you understand what I mean?
I do. I think that what we've established is that there's really not a strong element within law to stop you from flying these drones. And the worst-case scenario is a park ranger is going to give you a £20 fine. But using it for videography out of the equation, do we think that the drones are up to at the price point, which is what's the Mavic 2 now? £1,000. Would you guys be recommending buying a drone for stills photography?
It's a specific area of landscape photography. I think it's a genuine area of landscape photography now. Whether it's you get in a higher perspective or you're shooting straight down, you see some really nice work.
You do
on Instagram that it can't be denied. And why? As a country, would we want to deny that?
Yeah.
When most people are flying it sensibly, and they're not going away, are they? Unless there is a blanket ban, which would be tragic, I think. And really tragic.
Yeah, I think it's a whole new genre of photography that can be opened up because, as you quite rightly say, there's some stunning images that are hitting social media and have been doing for quite a while now. Where the perspective is changed, or the perspective is such that you just can't get that when you're on the ground.
I also think one of the other things I worry about is that so one answer might be let's just introduce testing for everybody.
Yeah.
That's one thing you could do. And every time you introduce barriers to entry of something, particularly something creative, I think that has an ultimately negative result. You might put an age limit on it. Are we not like then you have to be 18 before you can operate a drone? Is that what we want? Like, I don't not personally know. Like,
I think to create retrospective legislation is going to be very difficult because there's a majority of them are toys sold in toy shops. You have the bigger drones.
There is a definite distinction, though. Like, I've had a go with some of the toys, and they are toys.
But the legislation is there for people using drones for commercial purposes.
But a Mavic is a toy compared to some of the drones that some professionals...
Yeah. If you look at the DJI Inspire, which is a real commercial piece of kit, that's a complicated thing to fly, and it's coming in at £3,500-£4,000 to buy it. It's not something that you're going to carry. That's going to be used more for professional videography and/or filmmaking. Yeah.
One of the things I do get asked a lot as well is about the commercial aspect of it, which I've also done a bit of research on. But one of the things that the National Trust talk about a little bit as well is that you're breaching data protection. Now, the thing with the data protection is that person has to be identifiable.
Mm.
So if you're filming a dot on the ground from 400 feet, that is not breaching data protection.
No.
Because you can't identify that person.
What does it mean about if we put it in the public domain that it is?
No.
Because what happens if I take a picture of somebody? A still picture.
Yeah, but they still have to be identifiable.
Right, but they can often be. So say I'm taking a picture of my children.
Yeah, it's not against the law that even if they're identifiable, it's not. Like street photography.
Yeah. If it's non-commercial. Yeah.
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 Yeah, but the difference is, like I always say, is if you photograph somebody in a scene, then that might be illegal.
Mm.
But if you photograph a scene and somebody's in it, that's different.
Mm.
Because that's you photographing a bridge and people are just walking under it.
Yeah.
That's nothing. No, if you're photographing a scene and somebody's in it, that's different from photographing somebody in a scene. Somebody in a scene basically is paparazzi.
Right.
That's where, you know, you've got your David Beckham walking and somebody's photographing. It just so happens they're photographing them, but they're walking under a bridge.
Yeah.
But if you photograph the bridge as a whole, but somebody's walking under the bridge, then that's different.
Yeah.
That's somebody in a scene, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Again, it's very grey area, and that's probably why or how they argue it in court.
Mm.
Because right or wrong, paparazzis are still out there, aren't they?
Yes,
they're
definitely
still snapping away and so on and so forth. They're still earning lots of money from it.
Yeah.
So maybe they're getting fined the same £20, which is nothing when they're making £100,000 on a picture.
The other thing about the commercial aspect and what counts as commercial is stated as well. And it's pretty much anything where you are paid for that footage or to create that footage. So say if it's like you're doing a bit of, you're flying around a house that's then going to be used for an estate agent or something like that. That would be
commercial work.
If you're flying up above a building that's been constructed as part of a survey, that's commercial.
Mm. Yeah.
Because you've been paid for that footage, whether it gets seen publicly or not. However, as people creating content for social media,
you mentioned this in the last one,
it's not. That doesn't count as commercial because you're not creating. You're creating that footage as part of a wider story that's going to be posted on social media anyway, and that includes YouTube. And whether that then generates ad revenue later on is insignificant. So
that's
vloggers,
on YouTube,
we're all right.
But let's say you were sponsored by a company to put that.
If you were sponsored directly to create drone footage, then
right, okay.
But if you're sponsored to create a video about their bit of gear that's not a drone, then you're fine.
Cool.
It's you've got to be paid specifically to create that footage itself. That would include a wedding, though. So if you're doing drone photography as part of a video wedding package, that would be commercial, obviously.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So,
it's a developing topic, isn't it?
It is. Fly your drones at your own peril.
So the long and short of it is you can have as many rules and regulations as you want, but you're not going to stop the illegal person doing illegal things.
Yeah, I think if you've got a thick skin and you don't mind a little bit of argy-bargy and people having a go at you in the wrong situations, and if you fly it carefully, like I think we've all done, you know, make sure that there's nobody around or there's very few people around and keep it away from structures and people, you're never going to go far wrong. The worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to lose it.
Don't be an idiot.
Yeah.
Fly it safely. Fly it sensibly. Losing your drone is another matter.
I'll tell you the only thing that's ever worried me, because I'm always conscious because I fly anyway, it is of the surroundings when I'm flying my drone. But what worries the heck out of me is the fast, low-flying aircraft that are whizzing around in Wales and stuff like that. Now, I know that the way that the aerodynamics of an aircraft work anyway, the chances are that unless it was very, very unfortunate, the aerodynamics of the aircraft would push the drone out of the way with the airflow anyway. But it just terrifies me that some freak accident...
So the fast jets that go through the Lake District and through Wales, are they below 400
feet? They can be in certain instances, yeah.
Yeah, through the MacLoop and so on and so forth.
But above the ground, though.
Yeah.
AGL, so it's above ground level they are.
But don't forget, they're no-fly zones for your drone. Where you try and take your drone off with the Mavic software, they'll actually stop you. I know you can override it, but they'll actually stop you on pre-warning.
What you may well find, actually, is those are below 250 AGL that may be flying at that, so above ground level. When I'm seeing them flying, they're above 400 feet, but they look a lot lower.
There has been some occasions though where I've been out with my drone in a place I'm allowed to fly it, and I've been at like 100 meters or something, and there's been a non-commercial aircraft that's just a privately owned thing, quite low.
Yeah,
it's been what their exact altitude is, I don't know, but it's been enough for me to bring mine down out of the way.
Yeah.
And as long as they're within a certain distance from structures or what's it, they can go low. It's not against the law for them to do that.
Interesting.
No. I mean, the chances are, even if you wanted to try and bring an aircraft down with
you'd
a drone,
find it very, very difficult.
The chances of you doing that is minuscule.
Yeah. But, you know, their argument is that birds can bring aircraft down. But it's normally in critical areas of flight, and it's normally taking off that they bring the aircraft down because they get sucked into the engine. And that's the concern. But the law states that you can't fly within
4 or 5 miles,
I can't remember.
No, that's just common sense, though, isn't it? Like you said, that's just common sense. To the law-abiding citizen, that's just common sense.
Yeah.
It is.
Anyway.
Right, I think we're pushing an hour again.
Are we? Really? I didn't see we switched that off.
No, I did it from here.
Did you?
About
Brilliant.
6 minutes late, so there was
awesome.
We're getting technical.
We're getting technically adept.
I missed it by about 6 minutes, though.
Right.
So I think there might be a six-minute gap in the middle that I missed because I was getting excited about wedding photography.
Right.
But I think we are improving with the technical.
So out of focus, and now we've lost 6 minutes. We just lost 6 minutes of film, but we've still got the audio.
That's why I was saying off camera that we maybe should have a fourth person here to do the...
absolutely. So please subscribe if you enjoyed this one.
Yeah, leave a comment down below.
Yeah.
Let us know what you think.
As I say, we're talking about everything photography, so some of you might not like some bits and some of you will love them.
We'll see plenty of feedback about the comments, because obviously the comments we're talking about, or the subjects we've talked about, they're just our opinions, aren't they?
It would just be
very interested if your opinions differ from ours.
Yeah.
Or if they do, it's Paul G. Johnson. Is that what your name?
Paul G. Johnson. Professional photographer with a scarf.
See you soon.
See you.
Bye.